Patrick Henningsen talks on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, all right, welcome to the program. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. We're live and direct for the next 2 hours. Thank you for joining us here on TNT, today's News Talk. Great to have you with us. We're going to be joined by a couple of amazing guests today. We've got a powerful program. Freddie Ponton is going to be joining us in the first hour on the live link from Europe. Freddie is covering Nakba Day in Gaza and also the latest from Ukraine. As you've heard recently, as we reported as well earlier in the week, major game changers have taken place in Ukraine. Russia is on the move, circling the second largest city in Ukraine, Kharkiv, in the northeastern part of that country. And that is going to be a major blow for NATO, but also for the Zelensky regime. Reports are that Russia's walked in to most towns and villages without any resistance whatsoever. And again, it begs the big question, ladies and gentlemen, which we'll talk to Daniel McAdams in the second hour. Where did all the money go? $130 billion by anyone's guesstimate in aid and military support for the Zelensky regime. It looks like a lot of that's been pilfered. It's been laundered, embezzled, stolen, arms turning up on the black market, ISIS carrying weapons that, quite frankly, Javelin missiles that should be in the hands of the Ukrainian military ending up in the hands of ISIS. What is actually going on? Anyway, we'll talk to Daniel about that and the failed color revolution in Georgia, a major blow to the George Soros regime change. Color Revolution International Syndicate has been thwarted in the Republic of Georgia. Everybody's screaming and losing it in the State Department. They can't believe this former Soviet Republic has dared to kick out all of these dodgy NGOs that are hell-bent on turning into a European democracy. You know what that means? Well, look at the results in Ukraine. Not very pleasant, is it? Anyway, we'll talk to Daniel about that in the second hour. Breaking news, and we have to share this with you, very important story has come through on the wires. Robert Fico, he is the Prime Minister of Slovakia. Very important, pivotal EU country there, Central Europe. He was shot earlier today, attempted assassination on Robert Fico. Reports are, we'll get the latest updates for you, but this is really important, and I'll tell you exactly why. Robert Fico is not just any prime minister in the European Union. He happens to be the only leader, or one of the only leaders, at least, that's genuinely outspoken and does not support NATO's proxy war against Russia in Ukraine. Surprise, surprise, he gets shot in public after official appearance there. They have apprehended the shooter, who's now in custody. And, you know, looking back at my history books, I can see some parallels here to Operation Gladio in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, a strategy of tension by NATO intelligence to thwart certain European leaders at the time. This was during the Cold War. Well, things are a little warmer than cold right now in Europe, so Operation Gladio looks like it's operational. Robert Fico, and really sad. Is this the way things are going in Europe right now? Are Western intelligence agencies or Israeli intelligence, are they knocking off leaders who oppose the hegemony of NATO in the United States? Is that actually what's happening? Are they sending their Ukrainian thugs to do the work for them? We'll find out. There's a lot of questions around this, and we don't want to speculate. I'm throwing a few possibilities out there based on history, but Robert Fico was shot and wounded on Wednesday today. Multiple shots fired at him as he greeted the public after a government meeting. Very sporting. Fico was taken to the hospital by security detail after the shooting, while his attacker was detained and wrapped tied by police. Here, local media reports 4 shots were fired as he shook hands with supporters outside a meeting in Hadlova, about 150 kilometers east of Bratislava. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is very sad, but is this an indicator of things to come? Is this the shape of things to come in Europe for any leader that opposes NATO's proxy war in Ukraine? Is this the international racketeering operation here? Is that what we're looking at here? Don't stand up against NATO or this might happen to you. There's no shortage of crazies you could get to do the job. Let's be honest. There's plenty of them out there. And quote, there is no doubt that the attack on Fico was politically motivated. says Deputy Prime Minister Robert Kalinak told reporters outside in Banska district, in an inability to accept the will of some part of the public, which some groups does not like, is the result that we have worked towards today, says the deputy minister there. And a lot of lamenting. This is a leader who, by all intents and purposes, you really can't pigeonhole Robert Fico. They're saying he's left. They're saying he's somewhat libertarian in his approach. Other people say his policies are conservative. This is a very experienced politician who's been in the game for a long time. He's changed his colors and his opinion on Ukraine. He's made that public, and that has been a major disruption for the operation for NATO to kind of get that perfect consensus that Brussels requires for everything in the rules-based international order. You can't have any dissenters. You have to have complete unanimity in everything. Everything has to be perfect, and it's not. There's a lot of dissenters, Viktor Orban, Robert Fico, and there's others. Spain is making a lot of noise right now at the top political echelons that they don't want any part of this losing project, this World War III project in Ukraine. Ditto with Gaza. We'll talk about Gaza with our next guest, Freddie Ponton, but this is just really tragic what's happened here. And we're keeping an eye on some of the live updates here. Obviously, we're interested in his condition. Russian President Vladimir Putin said that he was indignant to hear the heinous attempt on Fico's life. I know Robert Fico to be a courageous, strong-spirited man. I very much hope that these qualities will help him withstand this difficult situation, says the Russian president in an official statement issued by the Kremlin. Ladies and gentlemen, unbelievable. It's the bad old days again in Europe. Operation Gladio lives. That's the way we see it. We'll hear what you have to say in the TNT chat community. If you have any comments on this, we'd love to hear them. In the meantime, let's take a break with the network. And when we come back, let's connect Freddie Ponton on the ground in Europe. Maybe we'll comment on this event, but also Nakba Day, signifying another tragic point in history, the Nakba. We'll talk to Freddie about that as well as some more breaking updates on Ukraine. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Stay there.
TNT's Chris Smith.
A Supreme Court judge has shown no mercy at all to military whistleblower and former defense lawyer David McBride today. Despite McBride pleading guilty, and it's almost as if that meant for nothing, and telling the court he was trying to expose the allegedly corrupt top brass of the military, he wasn't there to lag on the soldiers who put their lives on the front line. He was sent today to jail for 5 years and 8 months. 5 years and 8 months. There are manslaughter convictions and convictions for killing people that don't get 5 years and 8 months.
Chris Smith on today's News Talk, TNT. TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission.
Our next steps to space.
This time we go back to the moon to learn to live, to work, to invent, to create.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, folks. Welcome back. I'm Patrick Kenningson, your host. We're going to connect with Freddie Ponton in a moment, but let's get some live updates here on the condition of Robert Fico. Fico was hit multiple times. This is the prime minister of Slovakia, one of the only countries to oppose NATO's proxy war in Ukraine. He was shot today multiple times in public. He was shot multiple times, and his condition is life-threatening, says the prime minister's office. They're hoping for a recovery in the intensive care unit. They made an announcement on their Facebook page just a few hours ago. He is currently being airlifted to a bigger hospital, it seems, and they're flying him to Bratislava, where he is right now. I believe he's arrived, and his office has said the next few hours will decide his health, whether he can pull through this or not. Ladies and gentlemen, this is so serious. It's really sad. History is fraught with examples in Europe where leaders are assassinated and major wars follow. I think we can't underline that enough. And here's a statement from the president-elect in Slovakia. His name is Peter Pellegrini. He's saying this is unprecedented in Slovakia's democracy, in the short history of their country. And he says, if we express differing political views with guns in the squares and not in the polling stations, we threaten everything that we have built together during the 31 years of Slovak sovereignty, says president-elect in Slovakia, Peter Pellegrini. We'll connect Freddie Ponton shortly, ladies and gentlemen, but this is just an unbelievable situation. We really hope that he makes it. It's very unfortunate that this happened. Potentially disruptive as well. We're looking at this as an act of political intimidation. Who's behind it? We'll find out soon enough, or maybe we won't. Maybe we'll find out much later. But it does follow all the patterns of Operation Gladio, a strategy of tension. Consider it a terrorist attack. Who knows? I don't know how to categorize this. But anyway, we'll keep a close eye on this. We'll try to connect Freddie. Maybe we'll get a statement from him on this as well. And also, we have somewhat of an update here on the Kharkov situation with the Russian Federation's counteroffensive. And they are on the move. Russia's offensive to Kharkov is also going to change the tide of this conflict, and it's going to be happening very quickly. Moscow's forces are advancing on Ukraine's second largest city, and more voices are having to admit the reality of this situation, the awful reality. If you're talking about it from a Ukrainian perspective, it's a great op-ed right now we're reading on RT.com from Tariq Cyril Ammar. He is a fantastic political commentator. We'll be getting him on the show later the week, either tomorrow or we're going to have him on the show on Monday. Looking forward to that conversation. He's written a fantastic piece here. He's based in Germany. He's one of the top political commentators right now in Europe. And he's making all sorts of comparisons historically here to the other point in history in the Second World War where the Red Army stopped the advance of the German Third Reich. The Nazi war machine, as it was marching eastward, hit a wall. That happened. And some of the patterns from some of those epic battles in the World War II, they're being repeated right now. Only this is not going to end well again for the Nazi forces. In this case, I know some people say, well, how can you call the Ukrainian forces Nazi forces? They do have Nazi battalions that are amalgamated into the Ukrainian armed forces. Tens of thousands of fighters, of mercenaries or whatever rank they are, they identify, they have swastikas, they worship Stefan Bandera, who was an SS henchman for Adolf Hitler. This is all fact, ladies and gentlemen. They erect memorials, monuments to their Nazi war heroes in Western Ukraine. So obviously there's an ideological element behind this. This is what motivates the upper echelons of the officers and some of the high-ranking Ukrainian military people. This is a little bit concerning, obviously, that NATO and the West are throwing all their support behind some of these radical battalions and radical individuals and radical ideology. But it's so funny how history doesn't often repeat itself literally, but it does rhyme, and it seems to be rhyming again in Ukraine. Unfortunately for the Ukrainians, that's the biggest tragedy of all. This country has been absolutely wrecked, and all this could have been avoided many times. They had 9 years to implement the Minsk Accords. They had it ratified by the UN Security Council. Ukraine dragged their heels and they were supported by Germany and France in that process of sandbagging the peace process in order to avoid any resolution to this conflict. Why? Because NATO wanted a war. Now we're finding that out now. So we're going to try to connect, still trying to connect Freddie Ponton, waiting for our signal from our producer. We don't see him on the line yet. But if he has arrived, do give us a little whisper in our ear, just a note to producer. Okay. So we're going to connect Freddie momentarily. We'll get him on the line. But that's the updates from Kharkov. I want to welcome onto the program our European correspondent. He is a researcher and independent journalist based in Europe, Freddie Ponton, joining us right now on the line. Freddie, welcome to the program.
Hey, fantastic. Thank you, Patrick, for having me. Thank you. Great to be here.
It's great. Now, Freddie, right now we're talking about the Russian counteroffensive in Ukraine's second largest city, Kharkov, in the northeastern part of the country there, just nestled above the Donbass. This has taken a lot of people by surprise. Well, not everybody. We and others were warning that this might actually be happening momentarily, and here it is. It's actually happening right now. Are you surprised by the lack of resistance, Freddie, that's being put up by the Ukrainian armed forces as Russia begins to encircle that city?
Well, I think that there was some kind of anticipations that the Russians will make a move. I think there's enough level of intelligence to note that the Russians were preparing something. There's a movement of troops, of course, on three different fronts, although it's still up north in the Donetsk region, also in Belgorod as well. So they didn't know where it was starting. They just didn't expect, I think, something that organized on three different battlefields and moving so quickly, so rapidly, and very quickly over a few days, basically being able to capture all the way down to the Donetsk River. So that was a massive and a very impressive military move. And as many reports have stated, it felt like the Russians were cutting through butter with a knife. You know, that was that easy for them to go through the line of defense, if we can call that a line of defense. I think clearly the Ukrainian armed forces are spreading thin, and there's very little resistance, nor they've had the chance, the time, or the idea to mine the field. I think it's, you know, they're running out of a lot of things, a lot of manpower and capabilities, because it's a large front line. It's impossible to defend it unless you have the human resources to do that. So, yes, I mean, it's an incredible move, Patrick. But also what's interesting, Patrick, here is perhaps the reason behind this move. I think this is where the question needs to be asked. Is it basically a kind of diversion? Is it something that perhaps the Russians are undertaking to and making it look as real as possible in order to drag the Ukrainians' reinforcement in that direction, and perhaps the real action will take somewhere else? Time will tell.
Yeah, that's a good point. If that's the case, and Freddie, wouldn't be the first time that Russia pulled a blinder like this. They get a lot of stick for, you know, half encircling Kiev. If you remember back in March 2022, in April, they had set up this position as if they were appearing to surround the capital of Ukraine, Kiev, and then pulled back. We found out it was because they were complying with a potential peace negotiation, which was negotiated in Istanbul. Of course, the NAFO trolls and everybody else says, oh, Russia, you know, was beaten back, and they fled with their tail between their legs because of the brave stance of the Ukrainians and Klitschko in Kiev. But we know that that's not the case. So what they did, however, the genius of that at the time, Freddie, was that this is what in military terms is called a feint. So they made a sort of faux lunge towards Kiev that drew all the forces and attention to that part while they shored up advances in Mariupol and Melitopol and some of these key points in the southern part of the Donbass. Are they doing the same thing to divert attention away from Odessa, for instance? Because really strategically, Odessa is the number one trophy. That if Russia takes Odessa, it's over. It's over for NATO. It's over for Ukraine. The game is over at that point. What do you think?
Yeah, Well, there are a couple of things at play here. Of course, going to Kharkiv is an important capture. It has a lot of meaning as well. It's very symbolic as well, more than just a military capture. But if it is a feint, which I believe it is, it still has to look very real for people to take the bait. So I think they've done a good job at making it very, very real, since they control both sides of the Donetsk River on the long distance as well. They blew up a bridge out there. So we can clearly see that they not only tactically outsmarting the Ukrainian defense, and on the other side, it is completely possible that they will have the ability to take both fronts. I would say this is a possibility for them to keep the Ukrainians very busy in the defense of Kharkiv, which might be a long one, and on the other side, really pushing towards Odessa and securing Odessa, because there's a lot of still a lot of activities going on there. You see a lot of bombings going on, missiles going there. So Odessa has never been forgotten. It's as you said, a priority strategically because of the access to the Black Sea. But you must also add to this reflection the fact that the presidential mandate of Zelensky is also up next Tuesday. So this is also something that's going to be interesting, and few people have touched on that. Larry Johnson has spoken about it on how this is important as well, because the legitimacy of Zelensky is going to be challenged, and I think the Russians are going to take the first opportunity to take him out if they can, because he's not going to be a legitimate president. The election was up. He's moving past that deadline. That means he's a rogue artist, on behalf of NATO, doing whatever it is. So I don't know who's going to get to Zelensky first, but if I was him, I'll hide. That's for sure, from Tuesday onwards. So all that fall into this timeline, if you will, and all these small details have the importance in order to foresee what is coming. But for sure, Kharkiv and Odessa are a primary target for the Russians, no doubt.
Yeah, and the thing about the whole Zelensky story on this is, politically, I think it's important, Freddie, that the people in Ukraine have never had a chance to have a referendum on this conflict, or, how it's being managed, or how Zelensky's doing, or, a reckoning for the 400,000 dead Ukrainian soldiers in 2 years. Yep. This is record-breaking stuff in terms of battlefield casualties. There's no referendum from the people. They can't take the public temperature. I mean, who wants to come and speak out on a street corner even against the regime on this? They'll get beaten up and maybe arrested. So they can't do it at the ballot box. They can't do it on the street. They can't do it in the media, because he has eliminated all opposition media. It all has to go under the state control. No opposition political parties, no elections. And so how are the people supposed to communicate whether they want to take any further down this road that Zelensky is bringing them, Freddie? This is an important question.
Yes, it is a valid question. I mean, clearly democracy is not on the top of his priorities right now. He's been dictated pretty much the terms on how to conduct himself, at least until summer. I think they're trying to buy time as much as they can, but I think they're running out of time. Whether we're talking about Ukrainian leadership or we're talking about NATO, I think it's really only a matter of time. This battle is looking pretty much final, and the final move is going to be pretty quite fast. I mean, if you look at the pace, the army, and they're not even deploying all their forces. They have reserve in the back. If you look at how they organized, and they are capable of moving, 10 kilometers in no time, So the way I see it, as I said, Ukraine is very fragile. It's very fragile from a leadership point of view, because Zelensky is really on an ejectable seat, if you will. And the possible replacement with someone like Zelensky is also extremely risky because of his kind of affinities with the neo-Nazi parties and battalions and forces as well. So all that also fell into the equations on how quick the Russians want to get these people out of any kind of power or possibility of power. And unfortunately, as you said, the people of Ukraine are the victims of all these charades, basically. They're paying with their lives, they're paying with the quality of life, and lucky are those that are left the countries, that have been able to escape this massacre, because clearly what's going to happen next is not going to be as pretty as what we've seen so far. It's going to be more radical. I think it's going to be real pure military instinct on the battlefield. And we can see that, young recruits are capable of making such a move so quickly. These are not strong forces, well rehearsed. These are young recruits coming up, all fresh, and they're capable of moving that fast. That just tells you what's coming.
No, absolutely. And so we'll be keeping an eye on that. Also, it's worth mentioning that both Kharkov and Odessa are ostensibly Russian regions. They're populated by Russian speaking people. Culturally, nominally, they are Russian. They're being sort of managed or ruled over by a kind of minority of radical military leadership and ranks that are being controlled by Kiev. So it'd be very easy for these areas to fall out of control of the Ukrainian political leadership and military, because they probably don't have the support of the people. And it's been more and more strict. They're grabbing people off the street, throwing them into uniforms, into the trenches, and they're dying within 72 hours. It's a very unpopular war, very unpopular military, increasingly so, and a very unpopular president. The accidental president, Vladimir Zelensky, looks like he's coming to the end of his sell-by date politically, where he's going to end up. They've already shipped Zelensky off to London. He's now he went from head of the armed forces there to diplomat, Freddie. He's been promoted to diplomat. He's the defense attaché or the Ukrainian attaché to London. It's kind of moving up in the world. Britain has big plans for Zelensky, it seems. Or maybe he's being prepped, Freddie, for a return the country. What do you think?
Well, it's like Ascot, you got to put your money on what you believe is going to win, So they're telling you exactly what's coming. I think for the Brits, it's quite clear they put their money and their bet on Zelensky, I think, for a while now. And when time comes, I mean, obviously, they don't want to upset the United States and their plan, but they're definitely keeping their options open here. So anything can happen. I think, as I said, and I always say that Ukraine will implode before the Russians arrive in Kiev. It's what is bound to happen. Now, maybe history will prove me wrong, and I hope it does. But in a certain way, at the end of the day, when you're messing around with a bear and you poke it for long enough, there's a time where you're going to start to feel the wrath, and I think it's coming.
Yeah, the other thing is a lot of people will point to polling in Ukraine as like evidence, for instance, of how many people, approve of Zelensky and the war effort, or, how many people approve of Zelensky over Zelensky. And there's all sorts of things baked into the polling in a political environment like that. One of them is that people in the country are not going to answer honestly to polling questions. I mean, that's even a problem in the United States when it comes to, let's say, do you support Donald Trump or not? In 2016, a large percentage of surveyors didn't admit over the phone or to a pollster, Freddie, that they supported Trump. So the polling was very skewed. It looked like Hillary Clinton had a massive advantage in the polling in 2016. That was one of the things that distorted that because of the political environment, it threw the polling off. It distorted the polling. The same is true in Ukraine. You really can't bank on some of the things that you're hearing in terms of the polling. It's a very paranoid population, that population which is left in the country, and ditto for people that are outside the country. If they're polling Ukrainian expats, that's not necessarily going to be an authentic survey as well, for obvious reasons. So I just want to remind people to take some of these things with a pinch of salt, look at the methodology on the polling, and consider the political environment, what that's going to do to kind of skew the results of that. Very important that people do that themselves. Now, Freddie, we want to talk about a few other things, but any other comments on the Ukraine situation? I mean, this is pretty extraordinary. Russia seems to have caught the Ukrainians on the back heel. There's a lot of panic going on in Washington. It's already an unpopular conflict in Europe as well. What's the atmosphere like in Europe? And if Russia does make major advances, and it looks like Kharkiv or Odessa or both would fall, would that change the political attitude of leaders in Europe, the public and the press, Freddie?
Well, it's definitely going to change the rhetoric, and you're going to get more of the Macron's rhetoric and other leaders, Olaf Scholz, and that we need to do more for Ukraine and all that kind of things. But really what matters is how this translates on the ground, you know, how much difference is, and what is your ability as NATO coalitions to make a difference, because you're not officially into this into this war, but somehow somewhere you are. And if you are, what is your ability to change the outcome? And the answer to that is zero. It is quite clear today that NATO is very much aware. I doubt that, you know, military intelligence with all the informations and the ability for gathering that informations, they at this stage don't understand that there's nothing they can do, because the Russian capabilities of manufacturing weapons and missiles and you know, shells and so on is so far beyond what NATO can do. And before NATO gets its act together, years will have passed, but Ukraine doesn't have any years. So to answer your question really precisely is, whatever comes out of Europe or United States, the West in general, it's irrelevant. You know, the one that actually gets to do the talking and gets to put the conditions of surrendering on the table will be Russia. And when Russia does that, then that's the end of it. Doesn't matter what the other guys are saying. It's irrelevant. It has no effect. And it doesn't actually transpired on the battlefield. So unless you're going to see any difference on the battlefield, which is going to kind of support the rhetoric, it's worth nothing. It's just, you know, it's a flash in the pan, or it's whatever you want to call it, but it doesn't affect the end results. And that's really important from a military point of view, is how much and what is your ability to affect the end result. And at this stage, I don't see it. I don't see how NATO can come up with something that's going to make a difference at the end of the day. And especially, I think this summer is going to be pretty much kind of a, you know, given a good idea how far Ukraine, you know, has in the tank, you know, because how much left, Ukraine has in the tank. I don't think they have much left. So this should be quite expeditive. And within the next 2 months, we probably will be speaking about this. But right now, as I say, the situation is not a stalemate. It's Russia is moving forward, and Ukraine is going to have to retrieve.
Yeah, it is kind of scary, Freddie, because one of the only things that NATO could do maybe to salvage some kind of, I don't know, credibility or some positive attention out of this in a weird way. Perhaps there's a sort of weird, perverted kind of NATO position on this, where they want to expand the war. They want to escalate. And somehow that's going to make it, to keep NATO relevant. Recent comments by the British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, he just said, Putin cut off gas supplies and has had a devastating impact on people's lives. Putin didn't cut off the gas supplies, did he, Freddie? Didn't someone blow up the Nord Stream pipeline? Didn't that cut off gas supplies? Didn't the sanctions that they put on Russia cut off gas supplies? Didn't the U.S. and Britain bully Germany to stop buying gas from Russia? Didn't that cut off the gas supplies? What is the British Prime Minister talking about? And this sounds like insane war rhetoric. It's like they're about to declare war on Russia and they're starting to literally make up lies. I mean, what do you make of a statement like that by Rishi Sunak?
Well, for me, when I hear this kind of statements and what Sunak said, it really looks like taken out straight out of the blueprints from the World Economic Forum. You know, so it's I'm not really hearing anything else but what I've already read in documents and the planning and the blueprints of the World Economic Forum. So I'm not learning anything. All I'm hearing is someone's repeating what he's been told as a young leader. And you'll get the same from Macron. And as I said, it will be repeated around the world. These are just the communications. That's what and how these people function. They have a signal and everybody has to come up with the same sentence, the same kind of rhetoric. And it's you know, if you tell a lie long enough, then perhaps people will start to believe it. In this case, Russia has to be the scapegoat for anything that happens, anything that is bad, anything that cannot be explained rationally. Well, let's put it on Russia, you know. So everybody's going to talk about interference, about Russia's trying to weaponize the energy sectors in Europe. But at the end of the day, you know, the bottom line is that, you know, they couldn't sell the story of Russia blowing up their own pipeline. It's just they had to come to the realization that this just didn't make any sense at all, especially when already some of this pipeline were not pouring any gas. It was only the gas left in this pipeline, so there's no reason for them to blow them up. You know, just turn up the tap and that's it. But I think we're dealing with something in a much bigger picture as far as, you know, economic terrorism. And we'll talk about that when I release the last part of the Nord Stream investigation. You know, I've been very, very much involved with the last past year in putting it together. And I think what I'm going to come up with is going to help. You know, I don't pretend to know everything, but I think what I'm going to bring to the table is going to be helpful for those that I work on the other side of the spectrum of these investigations. But one thing is for sure is we're not being told the truth. We've not been told the truth by the Danish. We've not been told the truth by the Swedish. And certainly, I do not expect the German to tell us any truth. So if no one does it, and if we cannot secure the support of the United Nations on the serious investigations, because the people cares. At the end of the day, this is a story of people caring about, you know, their security. That includes their safety, because we are allowing terrorist activities taking place on European soil or European seabed in this particular case. And on the other side, we allow them, these people, to get away with it. So what kind of message, what kind of precedent are we setting up? Unless people are starting to mobilize and pushing the larger supranational institution like the United Nations to do their job and to actually move forwards. You know, I think that's what Larry was trying to do, and other peoples, you know, are starting to move in that direction as well. And we must actually really be supporting this effort, because they're important for the future. And we've been pushed as being Europeans. And when is the time for being European? Nobody wants us to be European. So what's happening here? It's a double standard. It's a lot of hypocrisies going on here. And I think this is the time to reveal it. And I think we're getting extremely close, and some people are going to have to answer questions, you know, some very tough questions.
Yeah, well, United States' attitude towards Europeans is shut up and do what you're told, and we'll tell you what to say next. There certainly should be an investigation at the United Nations level on the Nord Stream. This is something I think people got to start demanding. And as the receipts start to materialize on this, who really did it, who was really behind it, we think we know who that is. It needs to be an international investigation. Otherwise, the international order, it's a very bad precedent for a country, especially when allies are blowing up other allies' energy infrastructure and then forcing Europe to go bankrupt. It's a kind of a dangerous precedent, and there should be an international investigation. We'll talk more about that in the future. Let's take a break, however, and after the break, Freddie, I want to get your thoughts and reflections on the Nakba. This is Nakba Day. So historically, it's very significant. I want you to tell us why and what your feelings and thoughts are and how this is shaping up to be a repeat of history right now in Gaza. I'm with Freddie Ponton, independent researcher and journalist. Patrick Henningsen, you're coming back with us in just a few minutes, so don't go anywhere. We'll see you in a few.
Hi, I'm Susan Lucci. I never thought about heart disease until I had my own heart event. At first, like so many other women out there, I ignored my symptoms. A slight pressure on my chest, shortness of breath. I thought, I don't have time to be sick. I had a 90% blockage in my main artery and a 75% blockage in the adjacent artery. I received 2 stents in my arteries. Stents developed through research funded by the American Heart Association. Those stents saved my life. I'm so grateful to the American Heart Association. Their research helped save my life. I can enjoy life with my children, my grandchildren, and my friends. Please, listen to your heart. The only reason I'm here today is because I did. Learn more about the American Heart Association's life-saving work at helpheart.org.
Even the thought of dementia can feel scary. It's why we put off getting help, even though we've noticed changes in our thinking or memory. But an early diagnosis can change everything, giving you medical help and a support system around you to help you live better. Start with Dementia Australia's online checklist. Because the sooner you know, the more you can do.
Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Welcome back. We're in the final segment of the first hour here. TNT, Today's News Talk. I'm joined on the line by independent researcher and journalist Freddie Ponton at LFC News Media on X, Twitter. You want to be following Freddie and everything that he's putting out. Freddie, you put out an excellent tweet this afternoon on the Nakba Day. Just explain to people why this is significant. And I'm going to ask you, is history repeating itself in Gaza? Go ahead.
Yes, absolutely, Patrick. I mean, today's Remembrance Day for the Nakba. The Nakba means the catastrophe in English. It's an Arabic word. And this is basically to commemorate thousands of Palestinians which were killed and tens of thousands expelled during and after the creation of the Israeli state in 1948. So this is what they are remembering, the suffering. This is part of the history. It's anchored in their history to die, and this is something that has to do with their families and the story of displacements. You know, in internally displaced populations moved into refugee camps since 1948, and the people that were killed along the way. So a lot of atrocities, amongst which also 5 villages that were massacred, literally, and people were massacred in these 5 villages, and they're really part, you know, embedded into these Nakba commemorations. But what the Palestinians mainly remembers is the mainly the Jewish Irgun, the Haganah, the Stern gangs, militias, Zionist militias entering their village at the time and basically killing people, women, children alike, men, putting them on the street, shooting them down, and then eventually moving towards expulsing, you know, displacing these people outside of their house, their lands, you know, depriving them from their livelihoods, and then more importantly, moving in their houses further down the line. So a lot of histories have been written about the Nakbas, a lot of books, a lot of references to it. And of course, it's filled with atrocity, bloodshed, and suffering for the Palestinian people. So they cannot afford to forget it, simply because now we are 76 years further down the lines. Not only they have to remember these atrocities, but they also haven't been given the time to process the atrocity committed against them for the past 7 months. So this is a very difficult exercise in terms, you know, commemoration is a moment of peace where you approach, you're trying to rationalize, you're trying to, you know, this is about remembrance. This is about honoring those that have fell in the battle during the resistance, or even simply the people that have died, innocents that have fallen. So this is what Remembrance Day is about. But unfortunately for them, it's also a reminder that nothing has gone better. It has not even got worse. It has gone wrong. And I think this must be a terrible and difficult time for the Palestinian, and my heart goes for them.
Yeah, it is. When I first heard about the Nakba many years ago, it was described to me by a very dear friend from Gaza, from the Gaza Strip, during the Second Intifada. He was explaining to me why this is such an important day of remembrance, a day of remembrance about a major historic tragedy, one which we are still reaping the consequences for 80 years later. And Freddie, also, I want to share a clip with you. I know you also talked about the food insecurity issue. I mean, the scenes, Freddie, of Israeli settlers pulling aid off trucks and destroying the aid, bringing their children out to stamp on the food, pulling it off the trucks. I mean, have you ever seen anything like this before? I mean, this is just insane.
It's just very hard to watch, you know, because I think there's a moment where you will think that people will go back to their humanity, you know, reconnecting with humanity. But there is a cognitive dissonance here that is embedded in the Israeli population. And I'm not saying everyone is accomplished with that, but clearly, apart from being a political display, because this is the extensions of political ideologies and views on how things should be conducted, but punishing people for 7 months and then civilians, you know, children and women, even men, young men, just telling them you're not going to eat, we're not going to allow you to survive. It's a clear message, and this is the message that has been on display during the hearings with the South African government taking the Israeli to the International Court of Justice. This is really how genocide starts. It starts with a siege, you know, with impeding with the Palestinians' right to self-determination, and then moving on to control every aspect of their life. And what we are saying is just a continuation of that. We are saying basically a desire to ethnically cleanse a group, a part of the group, and then more importantly, moving towards the extermination of the group. And starvation is a mean to an end, if you will. So seeing that on display for the world to see that these people are capable of doing that in a time where Israel is definitely losing the PR battle, and I think we can see that across the campus in the United States, and I think more and more people are awakening to the fact that there is really something wrong with Israel. Israel need to regroup and start to think about what they're doing, because there is going to be consequences to their actions, and it's coming.
Just a few minutes left, Freddie. I want to get your updates and also on thoughts on the ICC case, International Criminal Court. A lot of people were expecting referrals for individuals in the Israeli government, military. They're going to be potentially brought up on charges. This is the rumors we're hearing, and then Israel's threatened them with reprisals if they dare to do it. The United States is threatening as well the individuals. Then you have the ICJ, International Courts of Justice. I believe Egypt has also kind of come on board with South Africa. Just quickly, last couple of minutes, Freddie, give us an update on what's happening there.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, last Sunday, Egypt has made it very clear that they are going to support the South African case against the Israeli at the ICJ, the International Criminal Court. The idea is simply basically to provide them with more evidence, because the Egyptians have gathered a lot of intelligence, something they've already shared with the courts. So they have a kind of good track record of, and they kept this data. And I'm sure some of them have never been seen before. So I'm sure we're going to learn more about that. But it's also pointing out, I think, very clearly that Egypt has arrived at a breaking point. And it's not only Egypt, Saudi Arabia as well, and other countries in the Arab world are facing basically domestic issues. I think the peoples have had enough of this this genocide and these war crimes on national television, so on social network. And the pressure is felt politically and domestically. And I'm sure Al-Sisi is getting some intelligence report internally telling them, well, this is as far as you can go with Israel. Clearly, they don't want a Palestinian state. They don't want a two-state solutions. They're probably got intelligence that they're going to be invading Rafah. And I think that before this happens, the Egyptian has to take and make a move, made it very clear to their people that this time is over. The negotiation time is over. This was not fruitful. And Egypt has to now fly on its own and take its own direction. So that's going to be a very interesting thing to do. And I personally believe, that's my final comments, but the Erdogan visit to Al-Sisi has played his role as well in this sudden move from Al-Sisi as well. So something to watch as well. And then we'll soon be also seeing things happening the same in Saudi Arabia. I predict that.
Yes. Yeah. A lot of people are critical of Tayyip Erdogan, the Turkish president, that he's made some big noises, but still, you know, hasn't fully cut off all trade with Israel, but says he's planning to. Obviously, people are a little bit impatient, and rightly so, Freddie. They want to see results. Turkey's made some pretty vociferous statements against Israel in the last couple of days as well. So it's going to be very interesting to see if Turkey's ready to escalate. And if they do, Freddie, it'll be very interesting if what you're saying is true, that this could affect the Egyptian Israeli truce that's held for a while. I mean, isn't Israel in just a minute left, Freddie, but Israel's in violation of the Camp David Accords by invading and taking control of the Rafah border crossing. I mean, that's just an egregious violation of one of the most important long-standing armistice agreements we have in the world today. Your final thoughts?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's also definitely in the mix. I think a lot of things have been taken into consideration. This is not a small move from Egypt, you know, on the international stage saying they're going to support South Africa. This is a 180, you know, so it's quite clear that something big has happened. I believe it has to do with really the timing of the Rafah crossing and the invasions of Rafah. Now, we've seen some bombardments, we saw a lot of that, but a ground invasion on Rafah, Egypt cannot afford to be seen supporting or being entertaining Israeli nonsense any longer. So I think they had to take a very strong position politically to show their people that, look, we're not with them on that. That's it. That's as far as we can go.
Yeah, the violence as well, the scenes that we're seeing are absolutely horrific. Again, it merely mirrors the worst moments of Israel's initial bombing campaign over northern Gaza just at the end of 2023 there. I mean, it's just horrific what we're seeing, especially the violence and the killing of children. This is all being videoed. They have the receipts. They have the names. They have the identification numbers. These aren't forged statistics or anything that's being invented by Hamas, as the U.S. media and Republicans claim ad nauseum. No, this is real. And people got to start really looking at it a little bit more seriously, taking responsibility for it, because without the United States support, without the U.S. government support, militarily, financially, politically, none of this is possible. It just couldn't happen. Israel's completely dependent on U.S. support. So, you know, we'd like to see it come to an end at some point. It's been a black mark on history. It's been a black mark on humanity. It needs to come to an end, needs to stop. We'll see if the political will is there to do it. Shamefully, so far, it hasn't been. Freddie Ponton, independent researcher, journalist based in Europe. Thank you for joining us this week on TNT, Freddie.
My pleasure.
And do follow Freddie, especially on X Twitter. He is putting out some incredible material. That's where you want to be to get the latest and the best details and insights from Freddie Ponton. Also, we'll be retweeting him as well at 21 Wire. Top of the hour news headlines coming up, folks. When we come back, Daniel McAdams, director of the Ron Paul Institute, on the other side. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I hope you are too. We'll see you in a few minutes.